Great pleasure to welcome to the conversation once again Mark Rubinstein, author of Net Interest, a weekly newsletter on themes in the financial sector. And today, Mark, I look forward to speaking with you about your recent article, Other People's Money. And it's a fitting follow-up to the Berkshire Hathaway annual meeting because you talk about Berkshire and Warren Buffett and actually pre-Berkshire Buffett-run vehicles as well. And there's a lot of great insights there. So let's launch right into it. I'll turn it to you.
Thanks, John. Firstly, I should say I feel very humble talking about Buffett. There isn't a community out there that knows Buffett and his history and his thinking better than your community, John. So if I make any errors of omission or otherwise, then any listeners, please let me know. We've all got a lot to learn. But my interest was piqued by a number of relevant recent issues. One, clearly, as you say, John, the event last Saturday, the annual general meeting. But also, recently, there have been a number of deals in the private equity space of insurance companies. This began back in 2009 when Apollo seeded a annuity-based insurance business called Athene. It grew via acquisition. And just several weeks ago, they announced that they were buying in 100% of it. They owned a significant stake, but they were buying in 100% of it, merging the Apollo private equity business in with the Athene insurance business. And on the conference call explaining this transaction, the CEO said that there was something of Berkshire to it. And it kind of got me thinking that the history and track record of Berkshire has been so phenomenal, clearly, as everybody knows. It got me wondering why more investment managers, many of whom have mimicked the Buffett style of investing, but fewer have mimicked the Buffett structure of investing. And that piqued my interest and it got me asking these questions.
Yeah, absolutely. And we'll talk quite a bit about permanent capital as well. But it didn't start out that way for Buffett.
No, exactly. So I think most listeners will be aware of the history, the influence Ben Graham had over his formative years, his time in Columbia Business School, where he studied investing, and so on and so forth. When he was 25 years old, he set up a fund, not dissimilar to the kind of fund that any emerging manager might set up today. One fundamental difference, though, was his fee structure. His initial fund consisted of just six investors, family and friends. Actually, he was the seventh. But he raised $105,000 back in 1957. And the fee structure he put in place in that initial fund was this. He guaranteed investors a 4% return. This was more than a hurdle. This was a guarantee. 4% return. Anything over that, he agreed he would split with them 50-50. But in addition, any losses, he agreed he would cover completely. He had a little bit of his own money in the fund, but he said actually that his obligation to pay back those losses wasn't limited to the $100 or so he had in the fund. It was unlimited. So quite an unusual fee structure. Actually, as the years went on, he launched a number of other partnerships, and they had varying degrees of differences regarding their fee structures. Ultimately, he aligned on a single fee structure in 1962, which is the one that many, I think, today are familiar with, which is the 6% hurdle and then 25% of the upside above that. But it took him a while to get to that. It was 5 years or so before he got to that. And that's what he aligned on for all of his partnerships in 1962. Now, he was phenomenally successful. He didn't have a single down year, unusually. He beat the market in his first few months by 4%. So, and then for each of the following 12 years, he compounded at a rate of close to 32% a year before fees. Quite extraordinary. A lot of inflows along the way as well. He grew his investor base from 6 people up to 300 people. And by the end of 1968, having been running the fund for 12 years or so, he had grown his assets to over $100 million. And with a significant investment in the fund himself, he'd clearly become very rich and his reputation had grown. He moved out of the study he had initially operated in at home, a room off his bedroom, his rented home. He moved into offices, which are now well known in Omaha. And then he wound it all up. In May of 1969, he wrote to all of his investors and he said he was quitting. He gave a number of reasons. He'd actually foreshadowed those reasons 18 months earlier. There's a letter he'd written to them in October 1967, in which he, at that time, actually downgraded his performance target. And he cited at the time a number of reasons why markets were more difficult to manage. That didn't come through in his numbers, by the way, but he identified back in 67 that markets had become more difficult. And he kind of foreshadowed that he wouldn't be in it for the long term. May 1969, he finally closes it down. He gives four reasons. He says the opportunities for his style of investing were drying up. This was Buffett 1.0. This was cigar butt style of investing. His fund was now at $100 million too large for many of the small cap investments that historically he'd invested in to have any real impact. The third reason he gave was, he said the market's very interesting because something he's alluded to many, many times since. The markets had become more speculative. He identified that when he set the fund up, his own investors would take a three-year view over investment performance. But increasingly, even among his own investors, that timescale had shortened. And at the same time, a lot of other funds were being established across the marketplace, were offering higher short-term returns, and he was seeing more speculation in the market and more competition as a result of that. And then finally, there was the personal factor. He says he doesn't want to be totally occupied with outpacing an investment rabbit all his life. And he goes on to say the only way to slow down is to stop. And so in May 69, he announced that he was going to wind up the fund and spent the rest of that year liquidating the fund. And sure enough, wound it up. I'll pause in a sec, but he had most of his assets were liquid, so he was able to sell them on the market and return cash to his investors. He recommended that his clients reinvest that cash in his friend Bill Wayne's fund or in tax-free bonds. But in addition, he had two illiquid holdings in his funds. He had Berkshire Hathaway, and he had a company called Diversified Retail Company. And then Berkshire Hathaway, he'd taken control of. He took an initial stake in 62, but he took control of it in 65. Many listeners will be familiar with the story of that acquisition, of taking control in 65. And he offered to his investors that they retain, that there would be an in-specie transfer. They would retain the shares pro rata that the fund had owned in Berkshire Hathaway. But what was interesting is he absolved himself of any fiduciary duty. He said, and I quote, "I want to stress that I will not be in a managerial or partnership status with you regarding your future holdings of such securities, i.e. Berkshire Hathaway stock. You'll be free to do with it what you wish." He says, "You'll be free to do what you wish with your stock in the future. And so, of course, will I." And then he goes on to say, "I think there's a very high probability that I will maintain my investment in Berkshire Hathaway for a very long period, but I want no implied moral commitment to do so, nor do I wish to advise others over an indefinite future period regarding their holdings. So releases himself of any kind of fiduciary duty, says that he may carry on maintaining his interest in Berkshire. Actually, he acquired more stock. So many of his investors sold their stock in this illiquid holding, and he took his family ownership up from about 18% of Berkshire, his prorated ownership once the fund had been liquidated, up from 18% to 36% by the end of 1970. So that's what happened. Wound his fund up. And you can gather from the quote I just read out that it wasn't 100% clear at that stage that he'd remain committed to Berkshire for the long term. And in fact, he also writes in his letter, he says, some of you are going to ask, what do you plan to do? I don't have an answer to that question, he replies. I do know that when I'm 60, I should be attempting to achieve different personal goals than those which had priority at age 20. At the time he wrote that, he was kind of 40, so halfway between those two ages. We now know that he didn't slow down. Remember, he'd spoken about wanting to slow down. We now know he didn't slow down. Berkshire became his investment vehicle of choice. And the rest, as they say, is history.
And we also know that Buffett's definition of fiduciary duty is probably a lot higher than the legal standard that public companies have to adhere to nowadays, because I think anyone observing Berkshire over the decades would say that he has more than fulfilled his fiduciary duty, including maintaining an incredibly low salary for himself. You talk about other examples of fund managers shutting down their investment vehicles as well.
Exactly. So there's a common theme. There's a common theme, and one of the tensions in running a fund is the tension between running it as a means to generate investment performance and running it as a business, the activity of investment versus the business of investment. And there are many ways that tension is resolved. In the big mutual fund complexes, it's resolved by offering a huge range of different products. But ultimately, as a business, these companies are run as kind of marketing machines. So there's a perennial tension there, which makes it difficult actually to institutionalize the business. And sure enough, there's a litany of historical investment managers who have, like Buffett in 1969, wound up their funds. So there's a number of examples I refer to in my piece. One was Julian Robertson, closed his fund in March 2000, Tiger, of course. He'd done 25% a year annualized. Another example is the Nomad Investment Partnership. Nick Sleep and Zach closed that partnership down in 2014 after almost 21% compound annual returns over 12 years, actually similar kind of time period to Buffett. Slightly different Bluecrest, slightly different because it's not fundamental equity investing. It was more of a London-based macro hedge fund, closed in 2015 to outside investors. The reason why I've picked those three is because what's interesting about them is the managers didn't quit. The managers didn't go off and do gardening or painting or photography or any other pursuit that might have appealed to them. They carried on investing money, but they did it under a different structure. The Bluecrest one is interesting because they continued to run as many hedge funds have gone on to do as a family office. In their case, it was a private partnership that was being run for the benefit of employees and partners. And what is interesting about that is performance improved significantly once that shift took place. So actually, Bluecrest went on to do 50%, 54%, 25%, 50%, 95% in the 5 years subsequent to winding up. And the benefits are the benefit, and there's a commonality. So, okay, so park that to one side for a moment, and let's come back to the other two cases, Tiger and Nomad. So there's some great quotes. Julian Robertson told the New York Times in 2000 when he wound up his fund. He said, it'll be nice to get out of the public eye. And then Nick and Zach said, and they wrote this, actually, it's worth flagging, all of their letters were packaged together in a single file that Nick Sleep put on his website in spring of this year. So in March, maybe 6 weeks ago or so, he did it with a afterword, which explains why they closed the fund. And they write that they wanted to feel they didn't have, I'll quote it, we wanted to feel that we did not have to justify actions or inactions on an ongoing basis to a revolving door of interested parties. So there's a common theme here is that basically, whether it's Bluecrest, whether it's Tiger and Robertson's analysis of the public eye, or whether it's Nick and Zach, this kind of idea, this scrutiny of clients, of external investors, which kind of relates back to something Buffett had said about the increasing short-termism around even his investor base. So I think in all cases, there was an appetite to shed that scrutiny and to be able to kind of invest ultimately permanent capital, which would be irredeemable, whether that's because it's their own money, in the case of all three of those examples, or whether, and we'll come on and talk about this in a sec, whether it's a corporate entity such as Berkshire Hathaway.
I really like the term revolving door of interested parties, because that's really what it is. I think even for funds that are long-term oriented and whose investors are ostensibly as well, it's just human nature that most people get nervous when performance isn't what it's supposed to be. And when it comes to permanent capital, that basically problem or issue is removed, and that's what makes that so alluring. Obviously, Berkshire is a great example of that. You talk about some other examples as well.
Yeah, precisely. So Berkshire initially, so it's difficult to know now with hindsight. I'm sure a listener will have the answer. Maybe John, you know, I'm sure Buffett has been asked the question before. But the question is, certainly given what he wrote in those letters in 69, it doesn't seem, there was no indication that he knew at that stage what was to come next. But at the same time, he had just bought an insurance company. And so he could have run Berkshire by itself as not so much an investment vehicle, because there might have been an issue with it being classified as an investment company, but certainly as a vehicle to allocate capital. And he was already doing that. So having bought Berkshire in 65, in 67, he used Berkshire to acquire an insurance company in Omaha called National Indemnity. Now, actually, it's an interesting question why he bought the insurance company via Berkshire. In his 2014 shareholder letter, he regards it as being the biggest mistake that he's ever made. He says that because because the partnership only owned 61% of Berkshire, by buying the insurance company National Indemnity in Berkshire, he was giving the benefit of the upside and his management expertise to the 39% minority investors that were also invested in Berkshire. And so back in 2014, when kind of looking back at his career, he estimates he gave up $100 billion of upside. by sharing national indemnity with those minority shareholders. Which is, so I don't know, so why, but he didn't explain why he actually did it. I don't know, maybe there's a regulatory angle, so I don't know why he did it. But what became clear, what would have become clear actually through 1968, when, because the founder of National Indemnity, who became very close with Buffett, the model of future acquisitions around securing strong management was in play in that acquisition in 1967. The founder stayed on. And unlike executives at other insurance companies, he was very, very focused, less on volume and on market share, but actually he was very focused on the investment side of the business. And Alice Schroeder in The Snowball talks about this. What's interesting is that in 68, I mean, 68 was a strong year in the markets anyway, but in 68, the insurance company investment portfolio performed very, very well. Very well indeed, actually. And so a confluence of factors. There's the permanent capital sitting in the corporate structure, Berkshire, which could be allocated not just to the textile industry, but potentially other industries. And he'd done that already in 67 in the insurance industry. Combination of that. Combination of then it clicking into place that the insurance business itself can serve as an investment vehicle, which it successfully had done in 1968. Combination of both of these factors created the foundation for this idea of float. We can talk in more detail about it. Very well-known concept amongst most people who understand what Buffett's done over the past 50 years. It injects some leverage into the investment business into his investment structure. But that all came together in kind of 67, and such that by 69, once he'd liquidated the fund and then went on to buy more Berkshire in his personal portfolio over the course of 1970, it all came together in the Berkshire we know today.
And the float, of course, grew tremendously over the years, in part because of the Geico as well as General Re acquisitions.
Exactly. So he fell in love with, he was already in love with the insurance business. Actually, there's a great story that from Columbia, he went up to Washington, D.C. to visit Geico. Ben Graham was on the board of Geico, so hence it screened positively for Buffett. He went up to visit. It was a Saturday. He said subsequently that he had no idea people in Washington, D.C. didn't work on a Saturday. The doors are locked. A janitor lets him in. And he finds a man who went on to be CEO of Geico, who spent 4 hours talking to him. Subsequently, his first career was as a stockbroker. And he wrote up the investment case. And it's available. It's on the internet. It's a kind of a 1951 investment write-up of Geico by Warren Buffett, age 30. Age 21 or 22 at the time. So he was very familiar with the insurance business. He obviously had bought his Omaha-based insurance company in 1967, and he went on to make lots of smaller acquisitions and then some big ones too. Geico itself, and this is also a testament to his patience, hit on hard times, and Buffett bought a stake. He bought 33% of it for a very good price in 1976. And in 1995, he took full control of it. So when he took full control in 1995, he then got his hands on $3 billion of float. And then in 2 years later, he bought General Re with another $14 billion of float. So over the years, he's increased his float from $20 million, which was basically the float that came with National Indemnity back in 67. And then at the end of last year, the float stood at close to $140 billion. So from $20 million to $140 billion.
And what's interesting is that Buffett basically viewed float as equity, because as long as an insurance company is not shrinking, that float will stay roughly the same or even grow over time. And so when he acquired that remaining a chunk of Geico and paid 2.5 times a book value, taking into account that float and viewing it as equity, brought the price down to only 1.0 times tangible book.
Yeah, that's right. And I've got to give credit to Adam Mead, who's written a fantastic new book, The Complete Financial History of Berkshire Hathaway. He does that analysis in that. It's a fantastic book. A combination of financial analysis, narrative, historical perspective. He undertakes that analysis, and that's the conclusion. That's the conclusion he comes to. But it makes sense. So float, it was low cost. Buffett has always made a case for it being, for it being, in some cases, negative cost. Actually, AQR Capital Management has some researchers from AQR did a long-term analysis in which they conclude that the benefit to Berkshire over its first 50 years of existence was 4.7% per year cost of funds advantage over the 10-year risk-free money. And clearly Berkshire, although it was AAA for long stretches of that period, wouldn't have been able to attract risk-free money. So a huge cost of funds advantage, point one. And point two, it's irredeemable. So although there's a lot of activity, a lot of turnover within the float, individual premiums come in, individual claims go out. In aggregate, just like a deposit base for a bank, it doesn't turn over. And so behaviorally, it is perpetual, it's permanent capital.
And I believe, according to AQR, they estimated that the structure allowed Buffett to basically apply leverage of 1.7 to 1 for the stock portfolio.
Exactly.
Stepping back a little bit, you also kind of talk about the past of permanent capital vehicles, and actually they seemingly go back all the way to the 19th century.
Well, this is the basic permanent capital vehicle would be a closed-end fund, so different from a mutual fund structure. And these were innovated in the UK, and as you say, in the 19th century, the very first investment trust where shares are issued to the public to raise money for a company whose sole purpose is to make investments. The first one was Foreign and Colonial Investment Trust, and it was begun in 1868. And investment trusts, very, very popular in Japan, very, very popular in the United Kingdom. And other investment managers have actually raised them in order to give them a source of permanent capital. So a great example is Bill Ackman. He issued Pershing Square Holdings Limited. He listed it on Euronext in Amsterdam in 2014, raised a huge amount of money through that. Other hedge fund managers have done it as well. Dan Loeb, there's a Third Point offshore vehicle, which is listed on the London Stock Exchange. Actually, private equity firms have tried it in the past. Apollo had issued one called AAA. KKR, before it went public, initially launched a permanent capital vehicle, also in Amsterdam, and ultimately reversed into it, which was the structure it employed to IPO itself several years ago. The problem is, and the reason why AAA, which actually is Athene, was born out of AAA, but the reason why many of them haven't persisted, AAA being one, the KKR vehicle being another, is because they often trade at a discount. And Pershing Square today trades at a 25% discount. Third Point trades at a 15% discount. They often trade at a discount. Various reasons why that might be the case, but they often trade at a discount. And those discounts get particularly wide in terms of market stress. And they also can't apply much leverage. Actually, Pershing Square, interestingly, Bill Ackman compares that structure. He says, although he only invests in public securities through that structure, he nevertheless, in his last shareholder letter, he compared it to a conglomerate like Berkshire, but he says actually it's a bit better, he says, because there are various tax advantages that he's got through that structure that conglomerates like Berkshire don't have. But they trade at a discount. And the second problem is often they can't apply much leverage. So Bill Ackman has injected some leverage into his structure, but it's very difficult for them to apply that much leverage. And certainly the London listed investment trusts are restricted in terms of how much leverage that they can inject. So that's one issue. And then you've got the insurance model. So, and this brings us right back to the initial question, why didn't other investment managers kind of marry the insurance model with a more absolute oriented investment approach? Some did. So famously Markel Corporation, Tom Gaynor, there's another great book out right now, William Green's book, Richer, Wiser, Happier, and he dedicates a whole chapter to Tom Gaynor. Obviously, phenomenally successful investment manager, now runs Markel, so similarly has married investment management skills with insurance skills, and he's grown assets at Markel there significantly. And then some hedge fund managers have done it as well. So David Einhorn launched Greenlight Re. Dan Loeb launched Third Point Re, which has now done a merger and is now called Sirius Point. So a number of examples, but clearly not as big as Berkshire.
In those examples, they're all permanent capital vehicles. But I think what's also interesting, and you write about this, is that some other asset managers out there that are not known as having permanent capital actually do have quite a significant portion of assets under management as largely irredeemable, and they've been looking to grow that percentage. So you write that Apollo Global is around 60% of largely irredeemable capital. KKR seems like it's around 43% now, and even Blackstone is up to almost a third.
Exactly, and there's a number of and the market likes that. By the way, the investors in now, these are public entities. This could be the fuel for it. Maybe there was less pressure when they were private partnerships to do this, but now they're public entities. The bear case, if you like, on KKR, Blackstone, Apollo historically had been their kind of melting ice cubes, that they raise a fund. It's the money's locked in for a long period of time, nature of the private equity business model, but they raise a fund. They distribute from that fund without a capacity to reinvest. They distribute from that fund and the fund closes down, and then they launch a new fund. So they're always having to reinvent themselves and launch new funds. Now, there's a number of ways in which this is a topic for another day. There's a number of ways in which they've institutionalized themselves. Blackstone, for example, has a whole multitude of different funds across a whole multitude of different strategies. And they're kind of asynchronous in when they, in terms of their investment periods. But the investor base loves permanent capital because it eliminates that concept of them being melting ice cubes. And so Athene was the first, or Apollo was the first onto this with Athene. Unusually, very competitive industry this, but unusually Blackstone gave credit to Apollo for identifying this and also then developed its own insurance strategy. And just a few months ago, KKR announced that it was buying Global Atlantic Insurance company, and that deal is just closed, which, as you say, took their share of permanent capital up to 43%. So they're growing their stake, and I mentioned this right up front, but Apollo, when they did the Athene acquisition, they do nod as well to Berkshire. So very, very clear that the shadow of Warren Buffett and of Berkshire Hathaway is being cast over these private equity companies, but they have an additional motivation as public entities to create kind of longevity in their business models that go beyond their initial founders, where all their reputation lies. And actually, again, sorry, just one final point there. We touched on this earlier on, this kind of tension between investment management as an activity and investment management as a business. Clearly, the value in a business has to be its longevity. It has to be the fact that it's an ongoing concern. And frequently, investment management is seen as a personal endeavor. And so the tension has been institutionalizing, taking away that kind of key man risk, institutionalizing it. And one way to do that is through is through permanent capital, as long as it's done alongside other strategies, which is what Apollo and Blackstone certainly have done. So that's basically it. So it's a very, very interesting development. And there's a kind of irony to it, which is the value of the float has never been lower. It's low interest rate. Now, we mentioned earlier that kind of 4% cost of funds advantage that Berkshire has had over the 50 years. That's been coming down, that advantage, as interest rates have gone to zero. So there's a kind of irony, is that these other firms are latching onto this idea just at the time when the advantage economically isn't as high as it was in the past, but nevertheless, very interesting development.
And things could certainly change in the future in that regard. Well, Mark, this has been terrific. Thank you very much for the conversation.
Thanks, John. Thanks. Pleasure as always.